Welcome to Inflection Point Podcast, where we cultivate change from the inside out as we ponder the Cairo question. Will Cairo have to protest in his lifetime for the birthright to freely and peacefully exist in the skin in which he was born? We stand on the belief that dismantling racism goes beyond laws and legislation or politics and economics. Here, anti-racism activation is presented as an inside job where personal transformation and accountability impact social change. So take a seat at the anti-racism activation table with Inflection Point Podcast.
Well, thank you. Here we are again with the newest episode of Inflection Point Podcast. And at Inflection Point Podcast, we are dedicated to the art of listening in genuine conversation. And we challenge our audience to listen for the purpose of understanding. And finally, we dedicate this episode to Tyree Nichols as a call to action. And I'm Anita Russell, your host, and I'd like to get a quick hello from co-hosts Mavis and Gail.
Hi, I'm Mavis Bauman. Welcome.
Hi, I'm Gail Hunter, and welcome to our session tonight.
Excellent, excellent. So we have a fully packed discussion this evening, so we're just going to jump right into it. The main theme of our conversation today is message to white women in America, and it's intended to be kind of these lessons in racial literacy. And we're going to start off with Gail, and she's going to lead us in a conversation around the patriarchy, a structure of white supremacy.
Okay, so patriarchy. Yeah, my son a couple weeks ago referred to me as the matriarch of my family. And I got this bad feeling inside. I said, I'm not really a matriarch, because I know that the word means control, right? So patriarchy literally means the rule of the father of the, or the patriarch, and originally was used to describe a specific type of male dominated family. Many large households had a patriarch, and they also included women, junior men, children, slaves, domestic servants, everyone under the rule of this one dominant male. And so the ideology of the patriarchal ideology really exaggerates the biological differences between men and women, and making certain that men always have that dominant or masculine role and women always have the subordinate or feminine roles. This ideology is so powerful that men are usually able to secure the apparent consent of the very woman that they usually oppress. And they do that through various ways, and even in the present time, through projection of blame, intimidation, gaslighting, and convincing their partner, the person, that they really aren't who they think they are, that the male knows more accurately what that truth is, which is just intimidation and control. So the traditionalists believe that men are born to dominate and women are born to be subordinate. And so the patriarchal ideology carries with it that what we've often heard called in our history, traditionalists, right? That the original framers, are the people that framed the Constitution, the people that originated the Constitution. It's often been known also as the conservative supermajority, historic American privilege, which is really white privilege. And certainly now, currently, we hear the term white supremacy all over the place. So it's as if we are finally calling it out as it is, and as it actually has always been. You know, in the Constitution, when it says that all men are created equal, obviously all men were not created equal according to that Constitution, and not even women were created equal. And so that in itself is indication of how strong that patriarchy was that had been adopted for thousands of years. And even in the present time, our Supreme Court, that they now call it originalism, that really is basically white supremacy and patriotism, patriarchy, framers, whatever you want to reference it as, but it's pretty much white supremacy. And so even though the conservative supermajority, they've been able to weaponize this very strong, powerful judicial philosophy as a way to embrace a racist patriarchal narrowing of political rights. And you can see that happening, even though we had our first Black woman appointed to the Supreme Court this past year, and she was sworn in. The slate of rulings from The very newly empowered right-wing and originalist court majority made it very clear that the court is motivated mostly by the reliance on the white supremacist patriarchy of the Constitution's framers. These rulings rely heavily on judicial philosophy called originalism, which argues that in interpreting the Constitution, we must hold the intent or the thought process of the framers or the patriots and patriarchies of what originally was going on in our Constitution. So the judges, certain judges were expressing that that became a precedent that they should not change. And certainly we can look at Roe versus Wade, what happened and how that began to be a setup for other possible changes to come if they succeed at that, right? So even though it's made up of a few white men and increasingly even white women, we have to question our inheritance of this historic American privilege, because it really is not going to help anyone, whether you are a person of color, indigenous person, black person, or white person. So the patriarchal white supremacy that is often called the originalism, they reached places in the 1800s, 18 after the Civil War, that they found compromises that they could make. But what they did was they just found another ways to continue slavery without calling it slavery. And so they, again, that's all white privilege, right? That's all fear-based, I believe, that they were frightened that they would not know how to economically succeed without having slaves. And they didn't know how economically they would continue going on and to still maintain the white privilege that they felt they were entitled to. And so it became a core piece of our government and throughout history that we've done certain different topics throughout the year, from the Black Codes to the redlining to even what's going on currently, that you can see the prevalence of that white supremacy that is not just men, it's women too. Women actually were part of the Ku Klux Klan, which I didn't even realize when I was reading into and looking at some of the history of that. They were very predominant. The only thing that they could possibly inherit was the ability to own was land and slaves. And so they were going to make sure that they fought for that before the Civil War. And certainly they found ways to fight for it afterwards. So white supremacy, traditionalism, patriarchy, whatever you want to call it, it is about the oppression of people that are not white. And when we look at that, it's really hard to say that that's not going to hurt everyone, including white people. And I really believe that we have to wake up and see how much that's actually hurting white people. There's an article, and I don't know if anyone's going to talk about that or not, about the white supremacy is defined by the belief that the white race is inherently superior. How does it hurt people? It's going to hurt people when it creates an inability for those that are Black or Indigenous or people of color to not be able to advance in their lives, to not be able to access their own creativity, their own intelligence, their own ability to experience and be all of who they are, because they don't have the financial ability. They don't have the history of generational wealth. They don't have the ability to go to educational systems. And so that's going to hurt all of us, not just those people. Different programs, such as affirmative action programs, are not just there to help Black people or people of color. They're here for all equity, right? For all people, and women included. It's also shown that by maintaining that, you can also stifle innovation. As I said before, it's not going to enhance creativity. It's not going to support the creativity of all. And our environment, I think that's the one that really upset me the most, right? That we have, just as in redlining happened in the 30s or 40s, when the government was actually behind that and geographically looking at what areas would be able to get mortgages for homes and which areas would not. The government has decided that there are areas environmentally that could be used to dump certain waste in that. And these are mostly all areas where there are people of color that lived there and they were disposable. So they looked at the people there as disposable, not just the geography or the environment that was disposable. And so there's so many issues that I think people are not aware of, that white supremacy is not just hurting people of color. It's actually hurting everyone. And the quote that Martin Niemöller, who wrote The Powerful Poem called First They Came, and the quote from the words of Dr. Martin Luther King, that no one is free until we are all free, right?
Right.
And things must change. I saw the article by Sarah Rao and Regina Jackson, who were the two women that did the deconstructing Karen, right? I think is what it's called. They really did a great job, I think, in helping people, white people, really take a look at themselves and look in that mirror, especially white women. White women throughout history, have, as I said before, have really enabled the white supremacy. And even though they are being oppressed themselves, and certainly they, as women, just generally women, let alone white women, we all still are struggling to find that place in our economy where we can be paid equally and respected equally and advanced equally. So that's affecting every one of us. But one of the things that they point out is that underlying need for perfection that white women have always bought into, and that is actually absolutely impossible to experience, right? That nobody is perfect. And so but that's a big, major piece of why women have maintained that level of connection to the patriarchy system and white supremacy, and believing that they must follow and must be in suit with the males who are leading that. And that somehow they will not be perfect enough if they don't go along with it. And they won't look perfect enough if they don't go along with it. They won't act perfect. I mean, it's sad. I mean, it's really to think about that many people who have bought into that expectation of perfection that doesn't ever exist anyways, just to justify white men mostly being able to dominate and control women and people of color. There's so much that we can learn from all of this. And that, it's so easy to just kind of close our eyes and not look at it. It's like anti-racism work really depends on acknowledging that we, as I said, we are all imperfect, and we no longer have to be nurtured by this supremacist society. But we have to acknowledge that we're all not experts, and we all are able to take a step into looking within that mirror at ourselves and seeing what parts we play, whether we're conscious of them or we're not conscious of them. That it's time to open our awareness and our eyes and ears and start looking within, no matter how painful that may be. It's crucial, and I think we're at a place and time in our own history where it has become extremely crucial.
Excellent, Gail. I had one little comment. It was around when you were talking about stifling creativity and innovation and all that sort of thing. I saw a cartoon once, and it was a cartoon of this like executive board meeting, and all the men in the board meeting, they all had the same hairstyle. They all had the same facial beard. They all had green shirts on. And the caption in the cartoon was, "Why can't we come up with any new original idea?"
Right.
Yeah, so it just made me, when you were talking, it made me really think about that. So that was amazing. That was amazing.
Yeah, very good, Gail. Very good. Yeah. I think I read somewhere, on the resources we were looking at for tonight, that perfectionism is just another form of racism. Mm. And that was kind of heavy hitting. If we all have to fit this tiny narrow mold,
right,
then we push people out of the center, mm-hmm. out of the norm, out of
that's right,
an acceptable diversity.
Right, it's like it fuels perfection. The expectation of perfectionism fuels it.
Mm. Good point.
Yeah, I always look at when people talk about perfection. To me, and I totally agree with you, it's like this unattainable thing. So for me, it's more like I look at it like I just want to be better today than I was yesterday. And whatever that endeavor is, I want to be better today than I was yesterday. So it's not necessarily looking all the way forward and saying that there's this pinnacle that I'm trying that I'm trying to get to. Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you, Gail. That was a very enlightening presentation that you just gave. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Could I make one more comment, Anita?
Wait, what'd you say?
I'd like to make one more comment.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Gail mentioned affirmative action. Mm-hmm. I think this whole subject is fascinating because what affirmative action mm-hmm. actually is not the narrative around it that you hear.
Right.
You hear, oh, we have to hire Black people. And that is not the case. It's just not the case. It is an effort toward improving diversity, giving other people or, you know, socioeconomic groups, whatever kind of group, and a mm-hmm. chance to be part of the action. Yeah. But it becomes a very racial term. I was on the beach one day here in my lake community, and one of my Black friends was visiting. And I heard one of the lifeguards say, must be affirmative action day. And, you know, everyone else on the beach was white. And I didn't even know what he meant, but it made me angry. And I went up to him and had a little chat. Mm-hmm. You know, he had no idea what he was saying. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He had no idea what he was saying.
Well, and the truth is they've done studies that it's actually improved productivity. It's actually increased organizations and their ability to be more innovative and creative. I mean, it's done the opposite of what is believed, right?
Yeah, what is believed, exactly. Exactly.
Right. Yeah, so just one final comment and then we're going to move on. When I hear people talk about affirmative action and they really don't know what it is, it always reminds me of when President Obama was in office and he was pushing for like more universal healthcare kind of thing. And the Affordable Care Act emerged out of that, but they nicknamed it Obamacare. And so it was really interesting to watch so many white people who kind of had the attitude that I don't want this Obamacare thing and everything because it's a handout or something for a certain group of people, not really mm-hmm. realizing, dude, it's for everybody. You can benefit from this as well. And people not really even understanding that the Affordable Care Act and Obamacare was exactly the same thing.
Mm-hmm. It was.
It's laughable.
Yeah, it is.
They hold on to that, their particular belief so tightly.
But that's that.
They will argue the two.
Yeah, everything goes to that lens.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So we're going to move on, Mavis. And Mavis's segment is on being nice and why it's never enough.
Right. I am going to talk a little more personally than Gail did her excellent presentation. I've been trying to dissect this concept a little bit, the idea of nice white women. And I think that there are two different avenues on this subject. One would be the type of nice white lady who believes that her niceness is enough to extend herself toward friendship with Black people to make them feel comfortable, that she's good, she's nice. She's good. That must mean she's not a racist. So that's one side of it. The other side of it is if I'm nice, really nice and smile, I can hide a whole lot of hatred and racism that's in me. And I know we've all seen people demonstrate this. I keep thinking of the movie The Help and how the white ladies treated their help. And what kind of pie was baked for them after that? But I just watching them is just they ooze the disdain for the Black women that worked for them, and even resented them for gaining the affection of their own white children, which makes no sense at all. They hire them and then resent them just because they're black. And then, like I said, the first part of this nice piece is, I don't know, I think most people would describe me as a nice white lady. And so I had to really look at that. And what did that mean? And was I offending Black people by being nice? Now, I think that I know where my heart comes from. I really am interested in knowing more about Black people, the culture, everything. And I love making friends with Black people, but I'm not sure how it's always felt from the other side. In fact, I was at a church led by a very good friend of mine, a Black couple, and I was thinking that this was around the time of George Floyd, but I think it was before. And we were talking about the difficulties of racism. And I wished I could remember exactly what the person that said, but all of a sudden it occurred to me that nice is not enough. And I remember my eyes kind of starting to fill with tears because I was surprised to see that in myself, that that was my operating system, you know? And this Black pastor looked at me and very subtly just shook his head very gently. And it just spoke volumes. I did not know about this huge body, this intractable system that we're all living in, that nice doesn't even chip away at. Mm-hmm. Nice might stop a conflict or prevent one from even happening. Nice might make somebody relieved when they're in line at the store. That doesn't help fix racism. You know, it really doesn't do anything. And so I think, you know, as white women, we need to be just very willing to listen, as Anita said early on, to these kinds of conversations and be willing to look deep inside to do some heavy duty self-reflection. What are we thinking on the surface and behind all of that? Like, I was nice to a Black person today. I put their grocery cart away or something. I mean, it's like, we are talking something so much bigger here. Don't pat yourself on the back because we as white women are still benefiting from this patriarchal system of white supremacy. So I've read Robin DiAngelo's work on white fragility, and, you know, some excerpts or reviews of her book called Nice White Ladies. And I find her angles very provocative. In fact, she, I think, was the first person who really initially knocked me over. she just put it in terms that I could understand, I guess. But as I was reading some of the reviews about her, people are still having very strong criticisms about someone who wrote something that makes white people feel guilty. And I'm thinking, you are hitting exactly at the heart of what she's trying to address. And they don't, the reviewers don't seem to realize that. It's not going to hurt me to feel a little guilty. It's not going to hurt me to feel a little bit ashamed of something I might have done yesterday, you know, unknowingly. It's only going to make me understand more and be more compassionate and more willing to get further along the road toward interrupting racism. So I just think, again, we have to listen at a level not to defend ourselves, but to see how we can think differently. And it's not going to hurt. I don't think it hurts. I think it's fascinating, really. There's so much we can do. So I'll leave it open to comments there.
Yeah, I would say the first comment for me is this notion that we can't see through your fake niceness.
Mm.
Yeah.
It's just so incredibly apparent. And so, you know, maybe it's when you talk about yourself being nice. When I first met you, I've said this 100 times. When I first met you, we clicked like that.
Yeah.
But it wasn't because I thought you were nice. Mm. It was because I thought you were cool. It's like,
oh, we want to be cool.
White woman. Yes. Like I could like talk to her. I could relate to her. I could have conversations with her. So it wasn't this fakey nice women, you know, this fakey white women niceness, because we can see through that. And it's always interesting to me, you know, I guess it's kind of hard for people to wrap their minds around the idea that because we experience racism firsthand, we literally have this internal radar where you can kind of pick it up. It's a vibe. It's a vibe. Or as Gail would say, it's an energy. Or sometimes I say, it's like sweat. It comes out of your pores. Mm. And we can tell. Yeah. So the fakey nice thing, it just doesn't.
Yeah.
It's more something for you than it is for me.
Right. Right.
I think it flies into that expectation of perfection that if I'm nice, then I'll be more perfect, right? But it's not genuine, yes. Right? And that's describing yes. it. Sensing mm-hmm. somebody's being genuine and not, right? And or just acting that part, you know?
A lot right, of us right. little girls were taught that.
Right. You know, and the movie that you talked about with the help, I think the reason why the white women were resentful of the Black women that were taking care of their children and their homes, because they felt inadequate. They didn't feel perfect because they saw these women and their children bonding to these women.
Yes, yes.
Separate mm-hmm. them, right? And rip that child away from that very person that loved them the most, that the child felt loved by the most, right? Because they felt right. their inadequacy because mm-hmm. they weren't able to be as free. They weren't able to be as open or present, mm-hmm. trying to be so perfect.
Mm-hmm. And I think another way for me to express where I'm coming from is we can tell when it's performative. The same way you can tell when a politician gets caught up in something and then he comes on TV and talks about how sorry he is, you can tell there's nothing genuine about mm-hmm. that apology. It's just a performance. It's just a part of the thing that I have to do in order to maintain my face, so to speak. So again, white women, just don't do that. We can see through it. We can tell when it's performative.
It's so simple. Just don't do that.
Yeah, exactly. Just
don't do that. Exactly. I don't know. That's such clear instructions to me.
Right.
It's not complicated.
Right? No, not at all.
You pay attention to what you're thinking. Do that.
Right. Yeah. And there was a quote on this one article I read that's talked about that you're not the expert on how it feels to be receiving the end of racism, right? If you're white, you are not the expert. Just as you would never, ever believe that men get to decide what is and what is not sexist, right? Us white people mm-hmm. cannot decide that for anyone.
Exactly, exactly. It's like what I say, you know, if you ask a man, describe right. to me exactly what it feels like emotionally, physically, intellectually, psychologically, to be in the labor room giving right. birth to your child. Not a man on this planet can describe what that feels like.
That's right.
And it's the same parallel, if you will. So we are down to the halfway mark and we are going to take a quick break and then we'll come back and continue the conversation.
It's time to tap into your divine self through angelic guidance. Join your host, Cindy Smith, and co-hosts in the Angel Empowerment Show from I Can't to I Can, airing every Monday, 6 p.m. Pacific on TransformationTalkRadio.com. Learn from four of the best angel empowerment practitioners in the field. Together, they will share experiential teachings and offer live on-air professional angel card readings and much more. For more information, visit CindySmithAEP.com.
I'm Patricia McNair, host of Divine Guidance with Patricia, and I'm here to help you live a more authentic, spiritually connected life. Join me every first and third Wednesday at 9 a.m. Pacific on TransformationTalkRadio.com. Being who you are in everyday life is the key to unlocking soul wisdom within that our whole self already knows. Get ready to embrace your spiritual, mental, and emotional well-being, your whole being. Discover your gifts and strengthen your connection to spirit. We will explore earth guidance, divine truth and love, past life lessons, and so much more. So listen in to Divine Guidance with Patricia and join in your personal adventure to triggering, opening, validating, and being all that you are. For more information about me, visit divineguidance.earth.
Imagine what it would be like to turn your pain into purpose. Tune in to Transformation with Martinet every second and fourth Friday at 10 a.m. Pacific on transformationtalkradio.com. Martinet and her guests are here shining their lights today through empowering stories of hardship and transformation. Begin to see your life in a new light. Visit martinetemmons.com and tune in every second and fourth Friday at 10 a.m. Pacific to Transformation with Martinet. To unleash the power of your infinite soul? Join Sherry Collins as she helps you remember who you once were by releasing your past traumas and stepping forward into your true self, living a life that you love. The show shares messages of hope, faith, and understanding. You can be the creative change that you want in your life. Soul Matrix Show airs every Monday, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern on transformationtalkradio.com.
Well, hey, welcome back. You are listening to Inflection Point Podcast on Transformation Talk Radio. And our theme for this show is Message to White Women in America. So we've heard from Gail talking about patriarchy. We've heard from Mavis talking about nice isn't enough. Now we're going to swing the pendulum a little bit and we're going to talk about weaponizing white womanhood and how white women often play the victim through their tears. So I'm gonna take you back probably like 10 years or so, or maybe even more actually. I think it was more than 10 years. If you all remember the woman, and I don't remember her name, but she was the woman, I believe it was in Boston, who made the claim that she was riding along in her car with her two children in the car, and a Black man came up, got in the car, stole the car with her children in the car, and drove the car into the lake. And the one thing that I remember so clear is when that woman was on television with all the cameras in her face and all of that, and she's just crying her poor little heart out and just weeping and weaving, like, how could anybody want to hurt my children? And the whole entire city was up in arms as they're trying to find this particular Black man who supposedly took her car and killed her children. And we all know how that story ended. She killed her own children. But the fact of the matter is, it was so easy for her in her tears to be able to convince somebody. And she didn't even have to do a lot of convincing. It was the fact that she was white and that she was crying and she was upset. And this big, horrible Black man had approached her and did this to her children. So the point I'm making is white women really know how to use their tears. And they really know how to play the victim, if you will, right? So if we think about, we all know like multiple Karen and Becky stories, right? The Karen story that sticks out the most for me is Central Park Karen. We all know how that story went. White woman walking through the park with her dog. And there was a rule in the park. The signs are, you know, around in Central Park saying, keep your dog on a leash, right? So the lady's walking around, her dog's not on a leash. So that's this attitude of privilege and entitlement right there. Like, I don't have to follow the rules, right? So she's walking along and she comes upon a Black man. The Black man is minding his own business. He's a bird watcher, minding his own business. And the white woman suddenly feels threatened because he reminds her there's a sign over there that says your dog is supposed to be on a leash. And so she gets all upset. And if a white woman isn't crying, their fallback is, I'm going to call the police. And that's what she did. So she's, and all of this is being videotaped. So she's literally making a phone call to the police, telling the police, you know, there's an African-American, I guess, you know, let me at least be politically correct about it and say African-American. There's an African-American man and he's threatening me. I feel threatened. I need some help. Please send the police. Please, you know, please send me some help. And it's like panicky kind of voice. And meanwhile, the guy's literally just standing there looking at her. Didn't walk towards her. Didn't do anything, no sudden movements or anything like that. And he's literally just looking at her like, I'm not doing anything to you, lady. What am I doing wrong? I'm just trying to watch the birds. Right? So then the police come.
He's so calm. He stays so calm.
He did.
You can tell by his own video that he's not advancing towards her or vice versa.
No, not at all. Not at all.
Yeah.
But to me, there was one little comedic element in that because the poor little dog, the poor little dog was like, Mom, let's just get out of here. Let's just go. Let's just go.
You about strangled that dog.
Yeah. But the point being, all I have to do is make the noise that I feel threatened and people are going to run to my rescue. And then it also reminds me of, if you remember A Birth of a Nation, I know I'm taking you way back, but Birth of a Nation, the scene in there where the white woman is like sitting out in the woods and she's just kind of enjoying life and, you know, smelling the flowers and all that, you know, virtuous thing that white women were supposed to do and be under this patriarchal system that Gail was describing, right? And then all of a sudden, this brute of a black man bursts through the bushes and he's got this deranged look in his eyes and, oh my God, and she gets up and she starts running away and he's chasing her and she's running and he's chasing and she gets to a cliff and she's, oh, I'd rather just jump off the cliff than have a black man touch me.
And she does, right?
And she does. Yeah. She goes off the cliff. But the point of that whole entire scene is the contrast between this supposed virtue of white women and the beastiness, if you will, of a black man. And any black man falls into that particular category. Right. And so there's an article in The Guardian, and the title of the article was How White Women Use Strategic Tears. I love the use of the word strategic tears to silence women of color. And here's a quote. The legitimate grievances of Black and Brown women are no match for the accusations of a white damsel in distress. And so when I saw that quote and this whole damsel in distress kind of thing, like when you hear that term, most of us don't think of a black woman as a damsel in distress. You kind of get this image of this white woman or the white woman that was depicted in Birth of a Nation where, oh, you know, and oh my God, my virtue and, you know, all that sort of thing. And so it just becomes, honestly, it just could gets to the point where it feels comedic almost. Like that's not real. It's just something that a person is doing. And again, the word performative comes into my mind. And then another quote from that same article, often, this is a black woman that's speaking. Often when I have attempted to speak to or confront a white woman about something she has said or done that has impacted me adversely, I am met with tearful denials and indignant accusations that I am hurting her. And so there's this whole entire thing, this whole story that's been woven around. We can't do anything that's going to help, that's going to hurt white women. Or, you know, we have to make sure that our children aren't getting exposed to Black history in elementary schools. I'm speaking DeSantis, because we don't want our kids to feel hurt. But it's okay for my kid to feel hurt, because my kid is going to school and I'm getting nothing around Black history. I'm not getting anything that connects to who I am as a person. So this is this expectation that we honor the feelings and all of that, the virtue of white women, even when it's at the expense of non-white women. That's a really deep place to be.
Yeah.
Right? That is a deep place to be.
You know, what I'm wondering is, in either the movie or in any of these Karen situations where women are carrying it on and acting like the victim, is there any place in their mind that is active saying, I know I'm okay, but I'm in a position to do this? You know, I always think about, what would I be doing in that situation? I'd be thinking, maybe it's okay. Maybe this Black guy is okay. You know, are they thinking of anything else but going the whole distance to accuse a Black person?
I mean, the way I look at it, the woman with her, the woman who had murdered her children, mm-hmm. she wanted to get away with murder. And it was very exactly. easy and very convenient because right. she knew that people would believe her story right. that a Black man did this.
Would have done that. Right.
Yes. And so her story was believable. Mm-hmm. From her standpoint of a white woman, the story was believable. So then also, if you think about the Victoria's Secret Karen. Mm. So here's this woman in Victoria's Secret. There's this white woman, there's this Black woman. Black woman's just shopping around, minding her business. The white woman does something completely inappropriate to her. And so the Black woman immediately pulls out her phone and starts to videotape. As soon as she started videotaping, the white woman goes into a frenzy and starts crying and, no, 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 I didn't mean to do that. And stop filming, you know, stop videotaping, stop. You just got up in my face in a public place, in a store. And now that you're being put on the spot, you tear up. That's the reason why
that's a way out of rude behavior then.
But that's the reason why I'd like this statement in The Guardian, how what white women use strategic tears. Mm-hmm. That was very strategic for her, because she was pulling the attention away from the fact that she got up in somebody else's face and didn't have to. And didn't have to. So again, the fact that it's strategic, like patriarchy is strategic. Yeah. The use of white women, virtue, all of that, it's all strategic. It's all designed to maintain the system.
Yeah, that's right. And the project blame where it doesn't even belong, as if they have every right to do that.
Right.
Not just to cover themselves up, but just to project blame because they can.
And that is the reason why people were upset with Robin DiAngelo, because she was telling the truth about them. I don't want to hear the truth, so I'm going to back off from the truth and tell you, you're hurting me. You're hurting my feelings. You're disrespecting me. Meanwhile, the whole entire system is set up to oppress, to hurt.
And maintain white supremacy.
And maintain supremacy through that hurt. Through that violence and everything, it's designed to maintain that oppressive state. Because, Gail, when you talked about the disposable, you have to have those disposable people. That's us.
Yeah.
That's us.
Well, in a system where there's a hierarchy like that, of course, there's going to be some group of people where there's going to be the ones that are disposable. Yet the truth is, all men and women are created equal.
In the eyes of God, definitely.
And by
Right.
virtue of the fact that we are all human beings,
Yes.
we all come into the world the same way, a sperm and an
Right.
egg.
Right. We are one humanity and
We
one
all come, it's all the same
race. Right?
way.
We're a human
Exactly.
race, yes. Exactly.
Exactly.
Right.
One of the other criticisms of D'Angelo was that she would go and lecture about, this racialized society and trying to shine lights on what we're doing. And then in one case, she did something offensive or dismissed a Black person in the audience. And it says, look at how duplicitous she is. Well, she realized it later and apologized and made an appointment to work on repair. But what I saw in that is she's still a part of our racialized society. This doesn't pull out like a shallow weed, This is deep, deep, deep. And I thought that's just no reason to indict her for still messing up.
Right,
Yeah.
because this is where we are, is where we have been socialized to be.
Right.
And to
Exactly.
undo that socialization, it's not something that you can undo just because you wrote a book.
No.
It's not something that you can do just
No.
because all now you got a Black friend at work.
Right.
You
Right.
know, this is
Right.
like deep-rooted, deep-seated. Like you gotta look within. Critical self-reflection.
Critical.
You
Yeah.
have to be willing to take those steps to do that, to understand who you are, not understand who you are within the context of Anita as a Black woman, but understand who you are within the context of you live in the same racialized society that I do. And what is your role?
Right.
And making a decision, is that what I want my role to continue to
Right.
be? Because
Right.
I
Right.
would say Robin DiAngelo made a decision. That's not the role I want to play, but I still got a lot of work to do in order
Yes.
to undo all that
Yes.
socialization.
Yes.
And
And
that's okay to know that, to say that, and to see that, right? That I
Yes.
still have a lot
Yeah.
of work to
That's
do.
the important thing.
What's important is
You
that you're
get
stepping
nervous
into
and
it.
you sit. Yeah, you say silly things. I do all the time anyway. And I'm just praying to be more and more aware and that it just goes out of my head altogether. And I have
Yes.
forgiving friends,
Well,
that let me progress.
I mean, the hardest work any of us do is to reframe a distorted belief system, right? And that's what this is all based in, is a very negative distorted belief system that was never accurately presented to anyone. And it was all for the purpose of greed and economy and so forth. And but to change that and all the layers and levels of where it is living within each of us, whether we are overtly, obviously, consciously thinking of it or we are not, but it's just been influencing us as white people. We all have the responsibility to ourselves and to our human race to look inside that mirror within us, right? And to look in the mirror that is right in front of us and see what part I can choose to do differently. Where am I in that process? And where am I and what am I willing to do?
I think at the very outset, a lot of white people just are horrified by the word or being called racist. Like that's the problem. Calm down. It's not like you're a murderer, or it's just a statement on how this society is structured. And I think if we can get past that word, what does that really mean? What does that say about what are we trying to identify in our society that is hurting everyone,
Well, yeah.
including you? The one who's afraid to be called a racist.
Right. And that fear of being called a racist is exactly the reason why I do the work that I do. So, because if your understanding of racism only develops through the lens of you being a white person, you have no idea what racism is through the lens of Anita Russell as a Black woman. So if you're not willing to step out of that and say, okay, there must be something deeper to this racism thing, deeper. I've never experienced racism. So if you've never experienced the same thing as what I was saying, if you've never experienced what it feels like to have a baby, and I mean to really be in the birthing process, you can't tell me how I'm supposed to feel in that situation. Right. And if you want to understand how I feel in that situation, you have to ask me.
And listen.
And listen.
Listen.
And listen.
And believe you.
And believe me, yes.
Right, because you're the expert of that, not the other.
Don't challenge the person that's telling their
lived
experience.
Right, exactly. And I say this all the time, my dear friend, Dr. Ida Jones from Morgan State University, who says, you have to harmonize historical truth with lived experiences.
Yes.
So the two components of that is the truth of history and then the lived experiences of that same history. Mm-hmm. And if slavery isn't your lived experience, and I mean generationally as a descendant from slavery, then you cannot tell me how I'm supposed to think and feel about being a descendant of from slavery. Like, that doesn't even make sense. Again, it gets back to, you as a man, tell me what it feels like. What it feel like for me to be on that table for 8 hours to get that baby out?
Or can I tell you to forget? Can I tell you to forget slavery? Can I tell you that? Are you kidding?
Or racism, right?
Or racism. Right. It's over. It's
you
over.
Can tell me. Of course you can tell me. But you're telling me from a very superficial perspective, because you're telling me to forget it. It isn't about helping me. But it's not about helping me. It's about appeasing you.
Of course.
Because the whole thing is, you have to feel comfortable. White people, white women, I just want to feel comfortable. Well, so do I.
That's right.
I don't want to cry because some 29-year-old man that I don't even know, Tyree Nichols, gets murdered in the street. I don't want to cry over that. I don't want to cry because I'm looking at George Floyd or Breonna Taylor or Philando Castile. Like, I don't want to feel all of that.
Right.
But I keep feeling all of that because this is the society that we have chosen. We chose this. Yeah,
exactly.
We chose
and continue this. To, right? And that's what can change. That's what must change.
Yeah. And I just want to emphasize the level of crisis that we're in.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's just such a soft peddling effort in a lot of forums to address this, you know, whether it's the news or whatever. This is a crisis. This, you know, our society is on fire in so many different ways.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had a friend say to me once, I don't want to know about things I can't do anything about. And I just thought, we can't have a world that functions in any sort of hospitable way if people feel that way.
Well, and
if they don't realize their own role. Yeah, sorry.
Right, the truth is we can do something about it.
Each do something, absolutely. Right. And when you look at Tyree and all of the conversations around it, and like I said, I watched the movie Till the other night, and I keep thinking, I'm reading the book about George Floyd, and I'm thinking, this is over a period of almost 70 years. We're not getting very far.
Exactly.
And that is unacceptable.
Right.
That is unacceptable to our Black sons and brothers.
Exactly.
Yes. Yes. And like I said, I'm sick of crying.
I know.
It's just grief, a grief that is a pall over the whole society, whether you want to acknowledge it or not.
Yes.
Yeah.
We have about 3 more minutes left. And I wanted to call out this quote, and we can wind down with this. So one of the things that we emphasize on our show is this notion of historical and racial literacy. So, you know, we come up with these different themes and different topics, but really the overall umbrella and the overall purpose of what we're doing and why we're doing it is to bring forth this stronger awareness, increasing racial literacy and increasing historical literacy. So I just want to read a quote, and this is from the National Council of Teachers of English, and it's really in reference to racial literacy. A desired outcome of racial literacy in an outwardly racist society like America is for members of the dominant racial category to adopt an anti-racist stance and for persons of color to resist a victim stance. Thus, racial literacy in English classrooms is the ability to read, discuss, and write about situations that involve race or racism. Right. Bottom line is, we have to talk about this. We cannot ignore it and just pass laws that ban stuff. Like, that's not going to make racism go away.
No.
We have to learn. We have to educate ourselves. We have to listen. We have to listen.
And we have to be willing to do it together.
Right, exactly.
We have to be willing to do it together. So we are down to the last, 60 seconds. And so I just want to thank our listeners for joining us today. And I'd like you to go over to the, when this shows up in the archives, because we have a whole list of giveaways. And most of the articles that we referenced today are in that list, right? So thank you for joining us. And we'll see you the next time at Inflection Point Podcast here on Transformation Talk Radio. And by way of reminder, we are here every first and third Wednesday at 3 p.m. Pacific time and 6 p.m. Eastern time. And we'll see you next time. Thank you for listening to Inflection Point Podcast, where our mantra is cultivating change from the inside out. The journey towards anti-racism and social change doesn't stop here. Truth, reconciliation, and healing come from ongoing, open, honest, and deliberate conversations. Continue to dive in and deconstruct your thoughts, ideas, and beliefs as we band together to manifest social change. Tune in to Inflection Point Podcast every first and third Wednesday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, here on TransformationTalkRadio.com for more conversations about how we can cultivate change from the inside out.
Views expressed on this program are those of the host, guests, and callers, and do not necessarily reflect the views of the station, its management, or advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.